Red Ice Radio. Thank you for tuning in today, ladies and gentlemen. It's always an honor to be able to speak with you. I'm Henrik Palmgren, and I'm from Sweden. Please check out our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, for much more. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to tune in as we discuss many of the important issues that we currently face. We talk about a lot of different topics on this program, and we expose many of the frauds of our times as well, from politics and the media to the fabrications in most of our history books. Most of it is really upside down, and unfortunately most people are completely immersed in a constructed fantasy that is detached from reality, be the obsession, mindless sports, subversive entertainment, or a cul-de-sac faux spirituality or empty scientificism that ultimately takes us nowhere. The results are pretty much the same. A non-aware entity that lacks comprehension of who they are and where they are. Well, one of our ways is that we aim to strike at the root of the issue in order to reach the truth. I think anyone who seeks the truth must have realized by now that political correctness, intimidation, and weaponized words and concepts indeed are measures that are aimed at shutting down basic inquiry. And of course, this is done so that we will let down our guard, or so that we will open the city gates, or to use another few analogies, weaken our immune system or disable our firewall so that the virus can be injected without a struggle, without a fight, without any opposition at all. This is, of course, done so that those who are seeking to control us and dominate us will win. Of course, if they can have you fighting for them, why not? If they can have you give up before we even begin, well, don't you think this is a strategy that they would adopt? This really is a war, my friends. It's a battle of epic proportions extending itself over many, many generations. And it's time that you get involved in any way that you can for our survival. But yeah, let's get to our guest here, Richard Spencer. He is the president of the National Policy Institute and editor of Washington Summit Publishers and Radix Journal. Spencer was formerly an assistant editor at the American Conservative magazine and executive editor of Tacky Mag. In 2010, he founded AlternativeRight.com, which he edited until 2012. He has also been a guest speaker at the Property and Freedom Society, the Traditional Britain Group, American Renaissance, and the H.L. Mencken Club. He holds a B.A., Bachelor's of Arts, with a high distinction from the University of Virginia, and a M.A., Master's of Arts, from the University of Chicago. He was a doctoral student at Duke University before dropping out to pursue a life of thought crime. Here we go. Hi, Richard. Welcome, and thank you so much for coming on the program. It's great to have you here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
You bet. So I want to just ask you a little bit about yourself here in the beginning, I guess, for those who don't follow, you know, MPI or Radix on a regular basis. What do you think newcomers should know about you, Richard?
Well, yes, I am the president of the National Policy Institute, and that is basically a think tank, and it's a global international one, and to a very large degree, a virtual one. And so we do a number of different things. MPI proper will host conferences, and these are basically intellectual conferences, but also social conferences. We try to have, you know, good time and facilitate new people meeting each other. And we'll have those about once a year, sometimes a little bit more often than that. And they'll most likely be on the East Coast of the United States and in Washington, D.C. And we actually hosted a conference or attempted to host a European conference this past fall. And that became interesting, to say the least. And we also have some publishing ventures. And so we produce podcasts, a lot like this one. The Radix podcast is out there. We have a website called Radix Journal, which is updated just about every day and includes really provocative commentary, sometimes from me, but from a whole host of writers. We talk about culture and things like that. We issue reports at MPI. Washington Summit Publishers also produces books. So, you know, to sum it up, we're just trying to build a culture around traditionalism and European consciousness and European identity, and building a culture around people who want to think about the future of Europeans, whether it's in North America or on the European continent or around the world. So that's pretty much who we are.
Excellent. Very good. I do want to ask you a little bit more about Hungary later. We'll definitely get into that later. But I thought we could begin to speak a little bit about the Paris shootings, the attacks on this magazine, Charlie Hebdo. It's a hot topic, of course. And we've had a few guests with us here in the past talking more about it. And I read a really good article, actually, on Radix, radixjournal.com, about, you know, basically, I guess, were some of the ideas of where this might be heading now when we have a European movement, a pro-European movement that is, I guess, considered to be more, you know, right. And we have certain divisions occurring within our own countries now. And at the same time, we do have an elite that is trying to piggyback, I see it this way anyway, a lot of issues on this movement. And the article is called Radical Traditionalist Critique of the Anti-Islam Movement, because obviously the response that's been evoked here is one of you know, disgust of Islam in the West and in Europe in particular. But how did you view this when you saw the attacks, you know, occurring, you know, Richard? Because I think there's a lot of interesting points to be said about the fact of how the West and the various intelligence services have used these kinds of, you know, events in the past for their own purposes. I don't know if you've gone there yet or not, but I think it's a very important point that was raised in this article that you had on the website.
Yes. Well, I don't know where to begin because it's a very complicated topic. And I am reminded of the adage that, you know, when you have a hammer in your hand, everything looks like a nail. And for the elite, they have a certain message that they want to propagate. And anything that happens just reinforces the message that they always wanted to do anyway.
Yeah.
So you could see that definitely in this grotesque march that occurred in Paris the other day, where after these terrible attacks occurred, we were all told to rally behind our fearless leaders, and we were also told that this was a great march for free speech and things like that. And of course, you know, these great advocates of free speech include Angela Merkel and the President Hollande and, you know, and other luminaries. I can only look at this and I just felt nauseated. I wanted to laugh and cry because it really is a joke. This event had absolutely nothing to do with free speech. And the people who claim to be the great advocates of free speech are absolutely not. They are the great enemies of free speech.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, included in this gathering of world leaders included Angela Merkel. There are people, as we speak, who are in jail, in prison in Germany, for holding and publishing controversial opinions about the Second World War. Now, some of those opinions might be truthful, some might not be, but that doesn't matter. The fact is that they committed no crime in the proper sense of the word, and they are in prison for thought crimes, effectively. And this is Angela Merkel, who wants to talk about her devotion to free speech. Perhaps she should start releasing thought criminals if she cares about that.
Exactly.
It's truly ridiculous. David Cameron has promised that he is going to ban all encrypted messages in the United Kingdom. And that actually includes iMessages, which are on basically, you know, millions of devices, millions of Apple devices. That includes WhatsApp. It includes other things. It's basically a very mainstream way of simply having privacy. And, you know, David Cameron, oh, you have free speech. You can say whatever you want. Of course, we'll be listening in.
Oh, yeah.
Just to make sure everything stays under control. And we might arrest you if you used a certain word or we deem that what you say is hateful. But, you know, that's how it goes. So anyway, the fact that any of these people were talking about free speech is just an absolute joke. And the whole event had nothing to do with free speech. It had to do with the strategic use of violence. I mean, ostensibly, and I've obviously, whenever an event like this occurs, there are all sorts of theories of, you could call them conspiracy theories. You could say, you know, what we think happened or what they say happened really didn't happen. And I treat all of those with a lot of skepticism because I think some people can get carried away. But let's just do this. Let's just take what happened. Let's just say what apparently happened did happen. And I wouldn't deny any other theories, but let's just put those aside for the moment.
Mm.
This has nothing to do with free speech. This was a strategic use of violence by certain people who are willing to kill and probably willing to die. And that's what it has to do. It's about a confrontation between two very different cultures. And so anyway, I mean, just to go back to it, I feel like it's the, you know, our elites, anything can happen they can use as a justification for what they already wanted, what they want anyway, and a justification for themselves. And I think maybe even the real challenge, you know, for people like us who want our fellow countrymen to start thinking differently, who want a different world to arise, is when can there be an event that really does kind of shake people out of it? When will there be an event where people will not start marching behind Hollande and Sarkozy and Angela Merkel and David Cameron after this event occurs? When will there be an event that will really make people think about the world differently and want a different future? And I think that's a major question. And you know, that's something that we need to be thinking about, it because I don't have a direct answer.
Well, you know, someone pointed out, and I think this is correct, that what has happened here is simply it's not the striking at the root of the problem. This is a symptom of it. I mean, the very suggestion that multiculturalism itself is what has enabled this very thing to occur. I mean, if we didn't have 6.5 million strong Muslim population in France, if someone would come along and say that, oh my God, we had jihadists attacking a journalistic office here in Paris, people would laugh at that and say, what the hell, what is this all about, right? So it's the idea that they've created a certain scenario to unfold within Europe, and now they're still defending the very policies that enabled all of this to happen. So at some point we have to, you know, realize that what is occurring, and just recognizing, you know, Islam, that is not going to the root of the problem, is it?
Right. Well, this is anecdote that I've used before. It's called the broken kettle. And it's a kind of joke that really gets at a human truth. And that is that one neighbor borrowed a kettle from his other neighbor, and then he brings the kettle back to him a couple of weeks later. And the kettle is cracked, and it's therefore unusable. And so the neighbor who lent the kettle out goes, the other one, you know, what's going on here? My kettle is now broken. And the other neighbor says, oh, no, that kettle's not broken. Oh, but also, that crack was in the kettle before you lent it to me. Oh, and also, I never borrowed your kettle.
So exactly,
it's
yeah.
It's kind of contradictory answers to the thing. So we have these elites that obviously, as I said before, this whole issue is not about free speech. That's totally irrelevant. And these elites are not even supporters of free speech, in fact. It really is about the confrontation of two cultures and the fact that these leaders have brought in these new populations. They're going to be problems. But using the kettle logic, it's kind of like, oh, well, this actually isn't about Muslim immigrants. It's actually about free speech or something. And then also, they're not immigrants. They're actually French citizens. And also, there's not a problem anyway.
Yeah.
There's not a problem. So it's this, again, this kind of contradictory explanations that they'll go through. And, you see this all the time in the United States. You know, we have one social program that seems totally misguided, and then we'll have, you know, two or three new programs created to correct the problems created by the first one. It's just this kind of, you know, endless cycle. And, you know, obviously we need a really fundamental change in these nations. And I think that change will be political, of course. But I think before that happens, it really needs to be spiritual, and it needs to be intellectual, not in an academic sense of the word, but intellectual in the sense of how we understand who we are, how we understand ourselves, how we understand what it means to be a Frenchman. You know, what it means to be a Frenchman is to be connected to an historical experience, connected to a people that is, you know, connected to an extended family. You could call it ethnicity or a race. And it means that you think about the world. You have a certain culture, you have a certain view of the future, and so on. And that's what it means to be a Frenchman. Being a Frenchman doesn't mean that you're devoted to, you know, legality or some abstract values. Right. That's meaningless. Anyone could be that. I mean, it's kind of like being an American today means that you like shopping or something, and you happen to exist within the North American continent. You have a pulse. Then you're an American. And you know, you're not. I mean, if these nationalities have any meaning, they've got to be connected to something bigger and something deeper. And that is that experience, that being part of an extended family and having a future together. And so, you know, again, I think that all of these things are just kind of symptomatic. They're problems. They're kind of ephemeral, little meaningless superficialities. We need to get at the deep stuff, the really big and important stuff. And that's where we need to have a fundamental change. Amongst Europeans and amongst Europeans in North America.
It feels to me like this is the very essence of what has been lost. It's not something that's encouraged in our culture anymore, as opposed to being, you know, a nation or connected with your people. We are now, you know, internationalists. We are humanists and, you know, pushing human rights and, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? So the liberal internationalists, our elites, they're are attempting, as you, to push, you know, democratic values and help to break down traditional values in other countries with the aid now of the West and in Europe in particular. And of course, your writer on Radix pointed this very factor out, that, you know, the neocons and those people behind, for example, the Project for the New American Century are, of course, kind of piggybacking, you know, on this anti-Islamic sentiments within Europe now as a way to kind of justifying their expansion of, you know, war into the Middle East and ultimately, which I see, which is equally to break down their traditions in the same way they've broken down our traditions. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yes, I would. I think there is a kind of, you could call it a bait and switch, or you could call it a fundamental confusion about Islam. And let me back up a little bit, because I think this is a very big and important issue. I have always been very skeptical of the so-called anti-Islam movement, or the sometimes called the counter-jihad movement. And the reason that I'm so skeptical is that from the very beginning, and I'm speaking from an American perspective here, from the very beginning, this anti-Islam movement has been connected with god-awful foreign policy, terrible stuff. You know, I don't remember much, you know, again, just my personal experience. I don't remember the right wing being animated by Islam until the events of September 11th in 2001. Mm. After the events of September 11th, there was a necessary and healthy awakening to, I would say, even to the existence of Islam. It's probably, for many people, it's not something they thought about. It's certainly not something that they thought about politically. It added a whole new dynamic to questions about race and multiculturalism and immigration and all those things. So I think that was good and that was necessary. But at the same time, why I have this skepticism about the anti-Islam movement is that from the very beginning, it was connected with American foreign policy, and it was connected with warmongering, and it was ironically connected with what might seem to be its opposite, and that is democratization, nation building, spreading Americanism at the point of a gun, and it was also connected with Zionism. It seemed to have all of these disconnected things were all just crammed in with it. And it was very difficult to separate it out. It was very difficult to separate out a healthy, necessary, real consciousness of Islam and its challenge from all of these other things, almost all of which I was opposed to. So for me, at least, you know, I graduated from college. Well, I guess I think in other, most everywhere else, people call that going to university. We still say going to college in America. Anyway, I graduated from college in 2001. I was actually in New York City, believe it or not, during the attacks. Which was quite an experience. But, anyway, from that point, it's just something that never appealed to me, because it was connected with let's invade Iraq, let's make sure that all Afghani women get an undergraduate education, and let's spend trillions of dollars doing this. Let's get behind Israel. Let's get behind the neoconservatives in the United States, like Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, David Frum, all these fine folks. And it's just not anything I could support. And I think the big problem with it is that, and as this the article that you mentioned from RateExternal.com points out, I didn't write the article, and I might have a little bit of a different perspective on it, but I definitely agree with it. I think the big problem is that when you confront Islam in the manner that it's been done, you're almost implicitly, maybe invariably, reinforcing liberal hegemony. And so, you know, you confront Muslims by saying, oh, we don't want to treat our women like that. And it's true. I don't want to live in a country where women are veiled. I don't find that at all civilized and attractive. I kind of like the arrangement that we have in the West.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, you start to have this notion of, oh, well, we've got to go liberate them. They've got to go to college. They've got to discover feminism. They've got to discover free sexuality and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So you begin to just fall into this trap of supporting liberal hegemony. Another thing that you reminded me of before we got on air was this so-called Jerusalem Accords. That occurred with that was supported by Philip Deventer and Geert Wilders and some others 3 or 4 years ago, where they went to Jerusalem, went to the State of Israel, and said, you know, we support you unconditionally. Your fight is our fight, and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't think that is 100% wrong. I mean, I think it is useful. To look to the Israeli and Palestinian conflict, and maybe we can learn some lessons. But that being said, no, our fight, that is not our fight.
Exactly. Yeah.
Zionism is not a part of the West. It's actually, ironically, if you look at its origins, and I think if you look at its present, it's a profoundly, deeply anti-European movement. And I don't really say that as a criticism, actually. It is a movement of Jewish consciousness and a movement of Jewish apartness. And it is not part of the West. It is, in ways, anti-European. And so, no, that is not our fight, and we aren't all on the same team. And I think this also gets to this other problem that I have with it, that it seems like when we focus so much on Islam, we get into these, how could I say, big global binaries, where it's Islam versus the West, or Islam versus Christianity, and it's an all or nothing battle, and we're fighting it on every stretch of land across the globe. Again, no. I am perfectly fine with Islam flourishing in non-European parts of the world. I don't really think that the West, so-called West, I don't think Europeans should be there. I don't think those parts of the world really need democracy or consumerism. I think they are fine to achieve their own destiny. And I don't think it's a big all or nothing battle. I don't think we need to confront them in any way. And I actually think that we should isolate ourselves from them. I mean, I think that's one aspect of a sane policy. This word isolationism is always been a kind of slur word in the United States. People say that, oh, you didn't want to go into World War II or something. You must. They right. Assume you're either a pacifist or a loser, or you secretly support Hitler, or both.
Right.
but no, I think isolation is a perfectly good policy. It's not, you know, I try to isolate myself from criminals all the time. Everyone does. It's totally natural. It's a way we can't solve all these problems, so let's not bring them into our backyard. So I think that is one aspect of it. But I think another aspect is that, you know, we as Europeans, we don't need to be hyper-liberal. Those aren't, you know, these have become dominant values, but these aren't our most fundamental values. They aren't the values that define us. They aren't the values of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. They aren't the values of the wondrous society of the Middle Ages or the Renaissance or what have you. These kinds of things are very new. These post Enlightenment notions, they're fairly new. They don't seem to be a sound basis for society. They seem to lead to unhappiness in many ways. These aren't really our values. And I think that we need to be able to confront Islam in a very different way than what we've been doing for the past, say, 15 years of going to war with them or talking about, you know, multiculturalism or as Barack Obama was doing in his first administration, wanting to raise Muslim self-esteem or something in order to prevent terror. No, we need to be ourselves, and we need to confront Islam in a very sane and very reasonable and in a good faith fashion. And we need to say, we are Europe. We are not you. You are not us. You are our other, and we are your other to a very large degree. And also, there's probably going to be conflicts between us. But we can live with you on this world. We have our destiny. You have yours. And, you know, often I'm sure our interests are not going to always be aligned. They're probably mostly not going to be aligned, but that's okay. And we can live with you on this world if we allow each other to be ourselves. And we will defend our land, we'll defend our people, and we'll defend our future and our way of life. I almost hate using that term. Those terms like way of life, they've been abused by people like George W. Bush. You know, we will not sacrifice our way of life. You know, you must be able to go out and buy new cars and go to the shopping mall. We can't let Osama bin Laden win. Or
yeah,
anyway,
that's right.
We'll defend our way of life, but we can share this planet, and I think that's how we need to confront them. But you know, I with the liberal, the liberal mind doesn't really. There's no exceptions to it. You know, you can't. If you believe that this human rights dogma is the one true way, it is a kind of a new monotheism in a way. If you believe that, then you can't allow Muslims in Iraq or wherever to not live like you. And I think this has been a very strong impulse in the West, and it's something that we need to recognize and we need to channel in different directions. This notion that if you know, an African or an Arab Muslim or whomever has a different path, has a different way of seeing, a different future. The liberal can't tolerate that. They can't look at some place that has a wildly different conception of, say, the role of women. And it can't accept that. I mean, liberalism, despite what it talks about, we love tolerance. That's all bullshit.
Yeah, that's right.
Liberalism is inherently intolerant. It's a monotheistic, totalitarian type worldview. And you know, we don't need that. In a way, we should be tolerant. We should accept difference and embrace difference and understand that the other is going to be different than us. The other has a different future. The other is walking a different path. And we need to be very anti-liberal and therefore, in a way, tolerant. And so anyway, I think those are kind of the new spiritual ways that we need to be. I think this is a kind of a different way of thinking about Islam and a different way of confronting Islam. Because the liberal way, the way of George W. Bush and Paul Wolfowitz, it has led to disaster. It's led to the deaths of more than a million people.
Yeah.
It's led to the wasting of trillions of dollars. It's led to the wasting of lives and energy. It's been a true disaster. And I don't know a single instance in which it succeeded at anything. It seems to be a total disaster. And we need to find a new way. And I think we're going to find that new way by thinking about these things spiritually.
Very good. I just want to emphasize that point you made there, that, you know, the current elites are doing the complete opposite as to actually accept how people are and the differences. It seems that they've decided whether they believe this or not could be debated, or again, if they're just piggybacking some other issue on that. But it seems like they have decided that in order to avoid future conflicts, we need to basically change, you know, human nature and who we are and who they are, right? And which is a task which is so insurmountable, as opposed to just recognizing these differences and saying, all right, this is who we are. Now let's work with that. The path they're taking is so impossible, and I think it's ultimately going to lead to ruin, right? Because, I mean, you can't be implemented. You can't beat nature, right?
You know, and I think in some ways we need to flip left and right around in a way. You know, there are a lot of these leftist slogans that whenever I would hear them when I was a young person, I would just hate them. I'd live and let live, you know, celebrate the difference, multiculturalism. But, you know, as I get older, I actually think that we need to adopt them.
Right. They're real, those. Yeah,
they're real. And I think in a way, many people who join the left were joining it for good reasons, but they were on the wrong path. And the way I would say that is that they wanted something different than Americanism, of consumer capitalism, of everyone's the same in the sense that everyone's a douchebag. We're all the same in the sense that we just all care about shopping and money and buying a massive new car and blah, blah, blah. And they wanted something different than that. And they wanted to break free of it. And they joined the left, which is the wrong path. But I think, in a way, a lot of those basic sayings of the left, not the leftist policies, because those are all equally bad, but the basic sayings of the left, like celebrate difference. I think we should celebrate difference. I think difference is real. Difference between individuals, difference between peoples, difference between civilizations. I think we should celebrate that, and we should recognize that in a real way, and, you know, be able to confront someone from China or an Arab Muslim or an African and confront them in a good faith, real way, saying that we are different races, we're different civilizations, but we respect you. Another one is live and let live. You know, again, I sound wishy-washy or silly or something, but the notion of allowing other people to achieve their own destiny, I think that's something that we should embrace. Multiculturalism, again, these are all kind of connected. Obviously, I don't support the multiculturalism put forth by our current elites, but I think cultures are different and cultures are real. I don't want the world to be the same. One thing that I've noticed is, when I was in Europe, is that I could get on a train, between Austria and Italy, and it's just a couple of hours train ride, but you'd experience a new language, a people that's just different, a new culture, a new cuisine, a new architecture. I think these things are wonderful. I don't want to live in the liberal world, whether the liberal world or whether the right liberalism or left liberalism, it's all the same. It's a world of a strip mall. It's a world of sameness. It's a world of bureaucracy. I want to live in a world of multiculturalism. And it's something I kind of experience a little bit here where I spend. I spend about 50% of the year in Montana. And a lot of Europeans probably aren't, well, they might not be aware of this. Maybe they are. But we have Indian reservations. And, you know, and these were actually established quite some time ago, but they're basically a kind of semi-sovereign land where these various Native American or American Indian tribes have some sovereignty over their land. And to be honest, these have in many ways been bad. They've either been places where sometimes the tribes will have casinos and whatnot. But in many cases, they're just places of poverty. They seem to have adopted all of the bad things about Western civilization and few of the good ones. They've adopted the alcohol and the drugs and the, you know, the bad, you know, porn or whatever, but they haven't really brought in the good things. And, you know, when I see things like that, I really wish the best for these people. I wish that they could discover themselves, rediscover themselves, and become Indians. And, you know, I think in a way, like, our movement, if I'm going to call it that, I think we need to think like that. I think we need to be more like left-wing hippies and less like conservative fanatics, if you understand what I'm saying.
Sure. I think it as well has to do with the problem of the current left-right division misconceptions, because obviously many on the left, for example, think that the neocons and, you know, George W. Bush and all the rest is on the right. You know, but as Paul Gottfried, who was with us a while back here, pointed out, these internationalists, you know, neocons, liberals, whatever you want to call them, have more in common with, you know, Bolshevism to a certain extent, of exporting revolution and democracy to the rest of the world. So the add-on to that, the question here becomes where this, to a certain extent, leave, you know, the new right, for example, in Europe or America, then, not to fall into this trap of becoming, you know, useful idiots for the elite, effectively helping to execute, you know, the Huntington's Clash of Civilizations or something like that, right?
Exactly, yes.
So what do you think needs to be done there for people to kind of get that dynamic and realize, so they don't end up, I guess we could talk about well-intended people who are, they feel really concerned about what's happening in Europe and America too, you know, but they are staring themselves blind on the initial target right in front of them, which right now is Islam. How do we divert them away from that and look at the root of the problem, do you think?
Well, I just think there needs to be a fundamental spiritual change. And I think this gets back to a lot of things that I've brought up in this interview. I think it's not going to be just a simple policy change. It's probably not going to be just one event like the Paris shootings. I think it has to be a deeply spiritual change. It has to be a different paradigm. And you know, we're probably witnessing the end of very strong enlightenment paradigms that have in a way kind of run their course, and they've become contradictory, and they've lost stability. They've lost a lot of things. I think we're at the end of that. We're in a way at the end of the age of the left right now. Sorry, I'm speaking in generalities, but I think sometimes you have to back up a little bit
sure.
to see the whole forest.
Yeah.
And you know, I think we're living at the end of the age of the left. And there've been different lefts with different notions of the state and different goals and plans, whether it's Americanism, an older version of Americanism, or a newer, whether it's communism, whether it's anarchism, so on and so forth. These movements have been very strong, and they have defined the age. I mean, there is no question in my mind that conservatives have not defined these past 250 years of human history. Conservatives have reacted to it, and they've responded to the left. The left has pushed history forward. It's made history, it's put forth the new ideas, and the right has kind of been spasmatically responding. But I think in a way we've kind of reached the end of it. We've reached a point where many people look at things that they once held as eternal truths. They look at them quite ironically now. You know, I mean, in the United States, I think people are generally content. I don't think we're in a revolutionary situation whatsoever. You know, we have enough, you know, new gadgets and, you know, funny social networks or something to keep us occupied. But that being said, I think that there's a great deal of irony. I'm not sure that, particularly amongst young people, whether they really believe in American values or the notion that America is the greatest country in the world and everyone wants to emulate us. I'm not sure. I think there's a lot of irony. There's a lot of acidic irony related to that. I think that, you know, irony seems to be the dominant form of communication if you look on social networks, things like Twitter, blogs, there's a kind of negativity to our current existence. And you could say that there was a negativity toward at the end of, in the Soviet Union at the end of communism. You know, in the final few decades of communism, where did the state gain its legitimacy? I think it gained its legitimacy to one extent just by inertia. It gained its legitimacy by maybe being connected to a Russian imperial tradition. It gained legitimacy in these ways. I don't think it gained any legitimacy in terms of Marxism, in terms of the very foundation of the state. I think if you ask people, your average educated Russian in, you know, let's say 1985 or 1980 or 1975, and you told them that you were living in a workers' state, a proletarian order of scientific socialism and equality, he would probably laugh at you, or at the very least give you a kind of wry grin and a wink, because no one believed that. And I think a similar thing is happening in the United States and in Western Europe, where if you say, America is the greatest country in the world, the most amazing place, it's a land of pure freedom and liberty and bravery, I think people would start, at least educated people, people who are aware, people who are thoughtful, I think they would start to look at you with a skeptical grin on their face.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think that is something real, and that is something important. That there's this ironic negativity that's embedded in almost everything we do in our whole world. And I don't know where this is going to lead. I mean, I don't know exactly what would come after America, but and this American world order that we're all living in. But I do know that we're at the end of it. And I don't know when it's going to come down, but I do know that it will, and I think that actually you and I might actually see that. There's a taste of death in its mouth. There's a bitter irony there, and I think that's something very real, and it's something that we should be quite aware of.
Yeah, indeed, definitely. So obviously, this is a good wave of discontent to surf on, and young people are more skeptical. They're suspicious, of the motives of the state for good reason, and of course, they are going to grow up in also a very different climate than, for example, what I did in Sweden. We started to get, a multicultural society, a lot of immigrations in the 90s, and this has just kind of skyrocketed in the last 4 or 5 years, really, which is just incredible considering how much we're, taking in already. But, I mean, that's going to be a very different climate to those young people growing up in that environment, and I think that they have a very different view on their own country and Europe and everything. And I hope that, as I said, that is a wave in a positive sense that actually can be surfed. And so where do you think the focus should be? I mean, it's something I've been thinking about a lot, obviously pointing out the hypocrisy of our current times and, how this is exacerbated by the mainstream media, et cetera. But to me, it's almost like it's more important to cling on to the things that are real, kind of what you said before, to a certain extent, an identity, right, of who we are and cultural values and really show that there's a different way and an option to all the insanity that we see in the world right now. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think we can have a purely negative movement. And what I mean by that is that, quite a bit of the movement in the United States, and let me just call it the alternative right or what have you. It's been kind of analytic. It's been, showing that, look at these IQ studies that I have about, intelligence and racial differences in intelligence. And look at this. This explains why, this explains black crime and why blacks don't do so well in school. And there you have it. And that's all fine. And I think my NPI has published things like this, and I think it's important, but it's really insufficient. We can't just be a movement, a negativity, something that points out, the neocons are bad, or, the politicians are lying. Well, of course they are. I mean, we know this, and it's important to say that, but it's not enough. And we've got to have something else. There's got to be a basis for something that goes forward. And, one thing that I've been thinking about from an American perspective, and you might think about yourself from a Swedish perspective, is becoming a minority. And, you know, I think for my parents' generation and for millions of Americans like that, America is basically them. They associate it with us. Like, oh, you know, they'll say things like, oh, are we going to invade Iraq? Or what are we going to do about Islam? Or are we going to get our economy going? You know, they think of America as us. And, you know, most immigrants and most non-whites in America don't think that way. They think of it as kind of we are us, and we're here in America. And I think we are going to have to start to develop that kind of consciousness too. And we're going to have to think about something like, well, you know, we live in this country, we like it, many great things about it, but, you know, we're a people here. And this country is not us. This country is not necessarily acting in our interest. It probably isn't. We are a people. And that is going to be, just psychologically speaking, that is going to be a very difficult process. Indeed, I think if you talk like this about becoming a minority in America to my parents' generation and some younger people, certainly older people, it's so foreign to them that I don't think they'll even get it.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, when you talk to a 20-year-old maybe who's gone through, you know, high school or college, or who's online and just sees all this stuff and so on and so forth, I think they are closer to getting it, you know, in their gut, in their bones. And I think that is a necessary first step, is to think of us as we're a people here, we're a minority here, and we need to have a consciousness of ourselves. And we got to stick up for each other and so on and so forth. But the first thing, we need to be conscious of ourselves and our identity. And we need to think about where we want to be. Not just necessarily what America is going to be doing, what Sweden will be doing, or what the French government will be doing. I think, indeed, we should probably stop caring about those entities. But we should care about us. And who we are. And I just think that is the spiritual and psychological evolution that has to take place.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible that it has to come to that. I mean, we have politicians now in Sweden, I mean, for real, literally talking, you know, to the cameras about, you know, oh, well, you know, we better treat the Muslims, you know, good now, because later when we become a minority, they're going to treat us good, you know.
Well, yeah, that will happen.
You know, well, exactly. Well, I think the idea here is that this, you know, ethnic consciousness that you talked about, a consciousness that is based on the fact that, you know, you belong to something, you belong to a people that have a history and a heritage and a culture, because I guess to make another point here, some people, that might be a contradiction. When I say culture, I don't mean the current culture of the West, for example. That's where the critique lies. But at the same time, I find myself, you know, defending, you know, Western values. And I don't think that is a contradiction, because I'm talking about something which is more, that goes much, much, much further back into time of where we had a clear kind of line of who we are. Let's say Swedes or Norse people, or be them, you know, Germans or, you know, Scottish people, French, what have you, right? But that's something that we have lost, and we no longer have that type of consciousness. I think this comes very natural to every other people but Europeans, to a certain extent. So that kind of, that sets us apart right there for some reason. And I don't know what this is, if this is the, you know, the virus of cultural Marxism, or where it is that has crept in there. But for some reason, we've kind of, we've allowed ourselves to go that path. And it's unfortunate.
Yeah, well, I think it is the virus of cultural Marxism. I think that's a real thing. But I think there are other aspects of it too. I think we want to transcend ourselves. I think, you know, telling someone that you're a white person, or you're a Norseman, you know, that almost seems limiting to them. I think we have this, Western people have this, you could call it a will to power, but you can call it a will to transcendence, that we think we're so much more. We think that we're part of world history. And to have ethnic consciousness is in a sense to take a step back. And I think we should recognize that, because I don't think we're gonna, you know, I don't want to be a part of a movement that is about like that, of saying like, oh, well, you know, don't have too many ideals here. You know, come on, back home. You're part of this small town. You're whatever. I don't want a movement like that. I think we should have a movement that is forward looking and dynamic and cares about the best things, that wants to shoot for the stars. But we've got to discover those energies within the white race and within Western man and point them in a new direction. I think now these, white people want to transcend themselves. They don't want to be limited. And I think that's good. I think that's something special about us. One thing about Europeans, we set goals that are superhuman. And I don't want to have this sound like I'm insulting other races, but I don't think the Chinese would have ever shot themselves on a rocket to the moon. and I don't mean that as an insult, because I actually greatly respect Chinese culture. There's just something about us that made us want to get on ships and start sailing around the world, not even knowing exactly where we would end up. You know, there's something about us that, Spengler called Faustian. And I think we've got to recapture that. We've got to channel that in new ways, so that people think of racial consciousness not as something that's limiting, but that as something that's liberating, that's something that's challenging, that's something that's revolutionary.
Very well put. I think it's about maybe at this time that, you know, we get this kind of reevaluation of our objectives of sort. It's a kind of a catharsis, a death process to a certain extent, and hopefully out of that something, new and more refined will occur. I mean, other people have pointed out that, other times when we've kind of let go to, decadence or whatever other things, something kind of knocks at our door, be that, Islam or other issues that occur, which is kind of starting to make our society or way of life kind of crumble, and hopefully out of that process something greater will come. Because obviously it's horrible to think that we would simply become minorities in our own countries in Europe and America, and then eventually just kind of passing away, and that's it. That's horrible to think about that.
But maybe we need to go through that process. And again, I don't know, because no one can predict the future. There's so many different possible outcomes, and things could dramatically change tomorrow after people listen to this podcast.
they could wake up. Yeah, exactly. No, but it's true. Well, every little thing helps, right? We gotta address it. That's just how it is. Yeah,
I agree. I'm not sure about this, but maybe we need to go through this process. Maybe whites in North America need to become 30% of the population in order to rediscover ourselves. And maybe that needs to happen in other countries, in Britain and Sweden and France. And maybe this is part of a story that we're going to have to live through.
All right, very good. I want to continue our conversation here in the second hour in a little bit. I have much more I want to ask you about, and a lot of good things brought up here already. We definitely can talk more about it. I want to ask you a little bit more, of course, about Hungary as well. But let's talk about your websites a little bit, and obviously where people can go to read more from you. Please let us know if you have any, book titles out there or anything else you'd like to inform our audience about, Richard.
Sure. Well, I would say the best place to go is actually radixjournal.com, because that is updated every day, sometimes more than once a day, and has very provocative things. That if your listeners have enjoyed this conversation, they'll definitely enjoy that. We actually have our most recent book is actually by a man named Alexander Dugin, who's a philosopher and geopolitical theorist in Russia.
Yeah, sure.
And we've actually translated his book on Heidegger, which is really worth your while. It's a very interesting introduction to thinking about Heidegger, and it's also a way for Dugin to explore a lot of his ideas that he also explored in books like The Fourth Political Theory, but to explore them in this philosophical context. And we've just got a lot coming out. We have a lot, a number of new journals, Radix journals coming out that I've been working on, one on the conservative movement in the United States and why it's so bad, and you know, a lot of other stuff, one on popular culture. So we have a lot of, we just have a lot of things coming out, some books on economics, some novels. So, so you know, for those types in your audience, I would definitely suggest they read that. And also, you can find out more at mpiamerica.org. That's the kind of general website. Or you can look at me at richardbspencer.com, where I, every blue moon or so, I'll write a blog there.
All right, very good. We'll have these linked up, you know, on our website, redixjournal.com, npiamerica.org, and the rest that Richard mentioned there. So do check it out if you're interested and want to hear more and read more, of course. But all right, we'll take a short break here, ladies and gentlemen. Stay with us. Stay with us, Richard, and we'll be right back with more. In the next hours, we continue with Richard Spencer. We get the story from him about what happened in Hungary last year. He had arranged a conference in Budapest with various speakers, some we've had on this program, by the way. And if you're not familiar with the story, he was arrested by the police. And of course, we'll talk more about what happened and why this happened, and of course, how he was treated during his time in custody. So if you want to hear the story of how a real live thought criminal is treated in a tolerant European country these days, don't miss this continuation. We also proceed to talk about a pan-European society, the European Union, Kudnov Kalergin, of course, where Europe is heading currently. We question if we can maintain who we are in a time when groups group together for the sake of appealing to more and more people and gain greater political leverage, both as victims but also as those who are to receive something from the all-pervasive oppressor. We proceed with the second hour at redicemembers.com. If you're new to the program, that's our website for our members, so you can go there to sign up and tune in. We have tons of shows for you there on a lot of different topics. Please take a look in our archives. I think you'll find a lot of programs there that's going to be worth your time. Well, we have more shows coming up as well, of course, with Octavian here. here next. We're going to talk about the stolen history of Romania. We also have Jeff Gates, Greg Alamein, Bo Olsson, Olav Thorheim, Carl Lehrberger, Sally Fallon, and many more. Just mention a few of the guests we have upcoming. But, all right, folks, we'll take a short break here. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.